Right, well, glad to see there's such a decent turnout on such a nice afternoon. So, welcome you all to the latest Sunday afternoon talk in our latest series. And today, Keith Scully's talking on British communism, which I'm sure will be a very entertaining talk, as Keith always are. So, are we ready to start?
Yeah, go on, yeah. Right, first of all, I should say I'm not going to go on for very long here talking. And you shouldn't expect too much political analysis because basically this is an open house for the party archives. I'm going to pass around some bits and pieces from the party archives and basically comment about them, and the talk is structured around that. First of all, I should say that this is a history of the Communist Party of Great Britain and closely allied groups. That's like Maoists and what they call anti-revisionists, which are the old Maoists. I'm not going to talk about Trotskyists because I did that last year. The other thing I should say is that to members of the Socialist Party of Great Britain, this is my little bit of politics, we don't see any difference between communism and socialism as words. For Leninists, socialism is a lower stage of a lower stage, and communism is the higher stage, but we don't see this difference. We take the Marxist perspective, the original Marxist perspective. Perspective of that. So I suppose in a way we could say that we're the Communist Party of Great Britain, if you like, because we've always stood for this, the what they call the higher stage, whereas they've never really stood for that, except as a distant prospect. Right, to start with, I think I'm going to go for my bits. Right, the Communist Party was formed in 1920, and this is my first exhibit. It's a reproduction of the Communist Unity Convention report. Basically, what happened then was the British Socialist Party. British Socialist Party was originally been a Social Democratic Federation. The Social Democratic Federation was the one that this party broke away from. The SPGB broke away from them in 1904. So they're our daddy, if you like. And they united with something called the Communist Unity Group, the Communist Unity Group. And this was a split off from the Socialist Labour Party. The Socialist Labour Party was their sister party, so there's a strong family resemblance there. There's a family connection. The Socialist Labour Party, I should say, had adopted Deleonism. We didn't do that. Deleonism is they believed in separate socialist unions, industrial unions, which means a conglomerate union. We never took that position. We because it wasn't a Marxist perspective, it was something that Deleon had taken and developed. I'm going to pass that round. During the First World War, the Socialist Labour Party had adopted when the during the November Revolution, the October Revolution, they had considered the Soviets to be socialist industrial unions, or there was a close resemblance, and they'd picked up a lot of support. The SLP was basically they were known as the British Bolsheviks, and they'd grown quite heavily on this, but because they had the perspective of opposing Labour like we did, that's why I say they're a sister party. It was very difficult to bring them in line with the Leninists. Lenin's basically laid down a tactical thing for 1920 that the communists should vote Labour and they should support Labour. And this was difficult for the SLP, so the Communist Unity Group broke away from them. I have here a thing from the Socialist Labour Party from the sort of time when they were actually into this. It's quite interesting because it shows that they'd fully adopted Leninism at this time, but it was a very divided group, and basically when the communists split off, the remainder of the party just went, basically disappeared, and was never seen again. The British Socialist Party, I should say, that had also been badly affected by the war, because it wasn't the same party as we broke away from. They dropped their leaders, which was Heinemann. He had supported the First World War, and he was out. So But essentially, the Communist Party was the British Socialist Party. The SLP a lot was, it was a fraction. It broke away. It had some of the early leaders in it, but not very many. And this is quite an interesting set, which is, actually, I suppose I should show them first. It's before and after. British Socialist Party. It's a Leninist pamphlet by Zinoviev. And it's got slightly different. It's 7 points. And it has workers of all countries unite. And the Communist Party version, about 3 months later, is cheaper. So obviously you got something out of joining the Communist Party, but your workers of all countries unite is gone. But it's very similar, and I think you could say that, in essence, the original Communist Party was the British Socialist Party and what was left of it. Right, there was also other groups that were added to the Communist Party when it, briefly after it was formed, and one of these was the Communist Party British section of the Third International. It wasn't the British section of the Third International, because it was an unofficial one. This was Sylvia Pankhurst's Communist Party. It was quite an interesting one, because originally it had been called the Workers' Socialist Federation, and that's what this pamphlet here is. It says it in here. And it was a East London-based group, fairly small, especially compared to the British Socialist Party. But it was quite interesting, because it had originated as a suffragette organisation. And it's quite interesting, because they turned against Parliament. First of all, they've been for getting the vote, and then they're saying, after the Russian Revolution, they've been turned, and they're saying, well, it's no good. We don't want, you know, what we want is insurrection, like those Russian guys had. Anyway, it's a rather nice pamphlet. It has a hammer and a sickle on it. And it's actually by John Reed. It's quite a rare pamphlet, actually, this one. Quite rare and rather nice. There were several other groups that were amalgamated in, but again, I think they were very small, and most of them were quite temporary. They were set up quite recently, before 1920, maybe a year or two. A lot of them were limited to the actual places where they were. They were like Scottish or whatever. And it's actually quite interesting, if you look at the Communist Unity Convention manifesto, whatever it is, report, because it's got a list at the back of it of all the different groups. Right, I should say, this is the slightly more interesting bit. This is about members of the Socialist Party who were founder members of the Communist Party. There were two of them. This is... Thomas Jackson. This is Tommy Jackson. He was a founder member of the Socialist Party of Great Britain and a founder member of the Communist Party of Great Britain. This is his statue, which is in the Working Class Movement Library in Salford. He has his own room there. And this is his statue in his room. When I actually asked, can I see the statue of him, the lady actually didn't know who I was talking about. They've got a room called the Tommy Jackson Room. It has his library in it. It's a massive, enormous library of Irish history. Enormous library. All of the books on Ireland that have been published before about 1960. So he was obviously fairly obsessed by that. He was quite an interesting guy. He was basically, what happened is he'd left the party over not over any particular doctrinal dispute or anything like that. He'd left because he wanted a paid job. He left fairly early on, about 1907. He got a paid speaker for the ILP. He was all around the left. He was in, you name it, anything before the First World War, he was in it. And eventually ended up as a communist. If you like to put it, it was rather nastily, I've heard it said, that he was a hack writer. The gossip about him is that his wife, his first wife, who was also a founder member of the party, she was Kate Hawkins originally. The thing is that the gossip is that he had such awful habits. He didn't actually wash, never washed. He spent all of his money on books. He just said that there's, you know, I've got this limited time on earth. I have so little time, I need to get these books, I have to read these books. I have no time for buying clothing, no time for washing. All I have to do is, on this earth, is read books.
And it's quite interesting. One thing that I read about him was that he supposedly became a socialist after reading the Communist Manifesto. And if you read his entry in the Dictionary of Labour Biography, it says that he was so impressed by the Communist Manifesto that it was just amazing and it lit up for him. I've got to say that my personal view of the Communist Manifesto is that you really need to, it's not something that really did it for me at any rate. Anyway, I'll pass it round. That's his thing. I was told not to display it on any costs, that one. It was not for commercial use. I had to sign a little thing that said I would not display it. The other person who was a founder member of the Communist Party of Great Britain... Oh, I should say that once you've done with them, I was going to put that box down there and you can put them all in the box once you've had a look at the stuff. Do you know, is there anyone here who would know who the other founder member of the Communist Party of Great Britain who was later a member of the Socialist Party was? Harry Young. Here he is.
Yes.
Yeah. I have some rather nice pictures of here.
Is that a bust of T.A. Jackson that's going around?
Yeah, it is. That's T.A. Jackson there. Tommy Jackson. These are reproduction photos. We've got the originals upstairs, which are actually, you can see them better. And this one's quite interesting because it's the 1922 Central Committee of the Communist Party. And it's actually got both of them on it. Harry Young's this guy here, marked with the X. And two doors down from him, no, it's actually four along, is Tommy Jackson. So you've got both of them in the same picture. This is outside King Street, which was later the Communist Party headquarters. It's quite a nice picture because also in there you've got Willie Gallagher. He's the guy up here in the centre with not very much hair. He was he's this figure here in the front row with not very much hair. He was actually the longest serving communist MP, 1935-1950. So I'm also going to pass this around. This is Harry Young during his trip to Moscow. He was a very nice looking young man in those days. As I said, these are reproduction ones. They're not very good reproductions. I'm going to have them scanned in and I'll put them on the internet for people. And this is Harry Young with his delegation. And they're putting a wreath at the grave of someone who I've never heard of outside the Kremlin. But I think it's quite a nice little set. And like I say, I'll get them put into the internet so you can have a look at them. The gossip is that Harry Young met Lenin, and that he met him. The story I've been told, which I think is an absolute lie, is that he met him on the toilet. His interview with Lenin was conducted while Lenin was on the bog. And I think that's an absolute lie. I've been told it by several people, possibly by Harry Young himself, for all I know, because I wasn't paying a lot of attention in those days. But I have this, since I've been told it, I just can't get the image of Lenin out of my eyes, because I imagine him sitting on the toilet like this, on a throne, and actually talking at the same time. It's a nice image, at any rate. Right, the thing I should say about the Communist Party as well is that because of its origins as these small sects, it always had these sort of, I mean, to a certain extent, I think organisations always reflect their origins. They can't help but do that. And it was created from small groups, and it remained a small group. And I think that's reflected in the origin. And I think you can contrast that with Europe, incidentally, because in Europe the communist parties were all taken as fairly big chunks out of the existing social democratic parties, whereas Labour in this country, in the form of the ILP, contributed almost nothing in terms of numbers to the Communist Party. It didn't come out of the sort of dominant social democratic movement. The 1920s. The 1920s, I think, were really the dominant thing in the 1920s in the Communist Party was that it was the relationship with Labour. Lenin had laid down this as a tactical move that you should, that communists should join the Labour Party and that they should be involved in Labour politics. This was very difficult for many of the sects. I shouldn't really use that word. The groups who went up to form the Communist Party because they were impressed by the insurrection, the October Revolution, the fact that it wasn't parliamentary, and they were impressed by that. And it was difficult to bring them in line, and it took Lenin's personal authority to do that. In fact, it was probably a very bad move because Labour actually wanted nothing to do with the Communist Party. And throughout the 20s, basically, it was a continual thing. First of all, the Communist Party applied to be affiliated. It was rejected. And gradually, they were entirely shut out from the thing. And I have a couple of interesting things from the 1920s here. Well, in fact, it's one thing. I think it's a fairly average publication, the Communist Party, in the 20s. It's not very interesting looking. They didn't really go in for style or anything like that. It's got Thomas Jackson article, which is why I chose it. But it's also got something about the political mind of Ramsay MacDonald, which is like, if you're trying to get into a party, if you're trying to join it, it doesn't really pay to slag off their leaders. That's not really going to, get your brownie points, especially because in those days, Ramsay MacDonald was a kind of hero. A lot of people had his, I've heard that they had his photo on the wall. They actually really loved old Ramsay Mac. I don't know if that's true, but because I can't imagine him. But he was certainly a favoured figure. Right, and so the 20s, basically, Labour refused it. It basically ended in this, the famous class against class policy. This was complete opposition to Labour and the trade unions, which is like, right, we've never done that, I should say. Our policy towards trade unions has always been a fairly moderate one. But it was against trade unions, against Labour, against everything. It was an incredibly unsuccessful one. They lost huge amounts of members. But on the other hand, the ones that were left were quite happy, really, because they could, they could say, well, October Revolution, we like that. We don't stand for Labour anymore, but they do stand for they do stand for Parliament. So it's not completely like that. Anyway, one of the things that kept them going in the during this period, which lasted from 28 to 35, was the Front. This is what I think is the most influential one. It's the National Unemployed Workers Movement. It was a thing set up by the communists, or rather, they took it over, and it was designed to get people to basically protest about unemployment. And this is from the National National Hunger March in 1932. It's by Walt Hallington, and it's got a rather nice picture on the front of a guy with a flag, and he's got a hat a little bit like mine, and he's marching to London. They weren't they were an interesting thing. They're something that was in the 30s, and I'm sorry to say that I think, why can't we have another one of these? At least it's doing something that's making it an impact to say we are unemployed, we are not very happy about it. And of course, all this front work was not actually very productive from the Labour Party's point of view, because they banned everything. And this is the communist solar system. It's a listing, basically, from the Labour Party, all the things you're not allowed to join. You're not allowed to join any of them. If you do, you'll be expelled. So the Labour Party was obviously, wise to this sort of thing. And they did not like anything to do with the Communist Party. They were very anti it. And one of the things in here, it's halfway through, it's the League of Militant Atheists. This was organised. I'm sorry, I'm back to Thomas Jackson again. It was organised by Tommy Jackson. As if you couldn't have guessed. In Russia, the League of Militant Atheists was quite prominent. It was involved in the anti-religion campaign, which was I kind of like that because I like the image of kind of destroying churches because I hate religion. But actually, it was a tactical thing because it was designed to destroy alternative centres of resistance or leadership or anything like that. You want the so it was a tactic on Stalin's part. It wasn't something that was particularly, he wasn't particularly an atheist as such. Because after the war, of course, or during the war, he reversed the policy when it was expedient to do so. Anyway, one of the people who was in the League of Militant Atheists, which I should say, it didn't go around burning churches in this country. What it did is it went to Hyde Park Corner and it heckled Donald Soper, which is not very productive, really, compared to Russian ones. But one of the members, a party member who was a leading member, I'm not sure if he was a leading member, he was certainly in the League of Militant Atheists, was Horace Jarvis. I'm afraid I don't have a picture of him. I have looked for him. If anyone has a picture of him, I would quite like it, because I like pictures of party members. But this is his pamphlet that he wrote called Christianity and Socialism. And it's a reasonable pamphlet, but it's not actually really about socialism as such. It's an atheist pamphlet, and it's criticising religion, Christianity, from a perspective of the actual text. And I don't really go in for text, and I don't think any person in the party really is very interested in picking holes in the Bible. But they might be. The other thing I should mention about this class versus class time is that this was when the Daily Worker was set up. I have an early copy here. It's, it's something that wasn't really a very popular to start with. The Daily Worker is now the Morning Star, and it's actually got a larger circulation now than it had when it started, which is saying something. Again, we've got, this is a Daily Worker, and again, it's got McDonald on it. McDonald's lies on any unemployment, and obviously this is from the class versus class type, so that's fair enough in those times, isn't it? It's quite a nice little thing. I should say that we have a small collection of notable items of this, and they were given to us by a man called Armitage, Andy Armitage, who's from Scotland. It's quite a nice little thing. I've got some other ones later, which I'll hand around. Right, basically what happened is they decided, particularly after Hitler came to power, that this is a bad idea. You know, there's a more pressing issue here than just opposing Labour. And of course, the thing was against fascism. And I have a rather nice anti-fascist thing here. And this is for the September 11th. Can't blame them for that. It's for the September the 9th opposition against Mosley and his guys. It's a very nice pamphlet. It's got some nice things in here. There's a train, which obviously appeals to me, being a train buff. It says, right away to smash fascism. Oh, the anti-fascist train. And there's some various other... posters that they've put up around London in here. And again, it's a very nice pamphlet.
Which year was this, Keith?
This is 1930... God, I should have looked this one up, shouldn't I? I think it's 1934, something like that. I'm not exactly sure because it's not got it written on it. So, yes, it has. It's 1934. It has got it written on it because I'm very thorough like that. I'm an obsessive, you might say. But it's a very nice pamphlet, and that is basically... It's so, you know, the Communist Party, you know, I'll give them their due. They were willing to put matters aside when it was urgently required to do so. Though, of course, this didn't prevent them issuing this thing, which was... I mean, 1935, of course, was when this class versus class thing was completely done away with. And what they adopted then was the Popular Front. I have a Popular Front here, towards the Popular Front. I've only picked it because it's in red, and it says in the back, Daily Work. I thought it was, you had to have something red to do. Just by means that it was red. But of course, being the Popular Front didn't mean that you had to completely pander to everything, because they also did have their... manifesto, which was actually, this was actually the first manifesto, or rather it's a programme. First programme to be issued was the For Soviet Britain. I don't think this would be, this would be against the Popular Front, because I think it would put people off cooperating with people, but it didn't seem to bother them very much. I'm actually very alarmed by this pamphlet, and the reason why is this giant woman on the front. She appears to be looming over my house with an enormous quantity of what look like giant marshmallows, and I'm hoping that she's not going to drop them on my house, because I won't be pleased about that. But anyway, that's for Soviet Britain. It's quite, like I say, they had the Popular Front, but they weren't willing to compromise as to their sort of their main aims. Of course, the other thing in the 1930s, which was a very big issue for the Communist Party, was Spain. This is supporting the fight for democracy, in inverted commas, in Spain. And we actually had a minor split in this party over Spain. One of the founding members actually wanted to go, even despite the fact he was about 90. But, you know, fair dues. It was, and the pamphlet, I should say, is from Cyril Oldfield, who was a member of Manchester branch. Unfortunately, I never knew him, and neither did Paul very well. So Paul Bennett, who's the secretary of Manchester branch. So I couldn't really talk and ask him about Cyril Oldfield or what he did or anything. But many of the pamphlets in our collection are from Cyril Oldfield, who was, I would like to know something more about him, is what I could say about that. The other thing I'd say, I'm going on about the 30s quite a lot here. It was because I think if you look at the stuff that comes out from the Communist Party of Britain, a lot of it's about 1930s. It's a very memorable time. One guy who I'd like to mention, this is from the 1930s, is a fellow called Snelling. Now, this is Frank Snelling. There's a picture of him here. I'll pass it around because you can't see it very well. But this is him meeting with Ernie Bevin. Now, Frank Snelling was the chairman of the London Busman's Rank and File Movement. The Rank and File Movements, this was an industrial, I wouldn't like to say front, since this guy was a member of the SPGB, who's their chairman. But nonetheless, I think it was a communist initiative at any rate. He wasn't, although it says there's a book which is on the shelves there called Radical Aristocrats. You can buy a copy if you want. Although it says he was a member of the party, he wasn't actually a member of the party when he was the chairman of the Rank and File Busman's. He was because he left the party. It's generally been acknowledged that I think if you were any sort of leadership, prominent position in a union, I think that you probably, it's generally accepted, I think, in the party that you shouldn't also be a member of the party at the same time. It would have put him in a lot of difficulties, since the Rank and File were known as, known as a communist movement. It's quite interesting on here because he looks a little bit like Enoch Powell. And he's next to Ernie Bevin, and Bevin is looking very pleased with himself, and Frank Snelling is not looking very pleased with himself. And the reason why is because Ernie Bevin's basically done down the busmen. He manipulated them because he wanted unity within his union. He manipulated the strike, which is 1938, busman's strike, so that the busmen would lose. And Frank Snelling is not looking pleased there at all. He's got a definite face on him. I have a selection of photos also of Snelling. There's one of him addressing, it's a composite photo. These are reproductions again. He's addressing a crowd in Hyde Park, and it's a very big one. And they've all got hats like mine again. I'm very pleased with my hat. And this is them on the roof. This is, in my notes here, it says that on the roof of the Union in Parliament Street. Down below you can actually see the cenotaph. So I didn't know that that was where the Union would be, which is TGWU. I didn't know that they would actually have been on Parliament Street at that time, but that's what the note says. And here he is. This is a very nice photo. Again, this is the London Busman's Rank and File Movement. Sutton Branch, he was a busman in Sutton. and he is right in the centre of it, and he's looking quite peeved again. Though he should be feeling happy there because he's got a nice hat on. It's a nice. I've no idea what sort of hat, but that's their social outing. Basically, what's quite interesting about him is after the busman had been betrayed by Bevin, he formed his own union, which was the National Passenger Workers Union. It was a breakaway union. We certainly didn't support it. He wasn't a member of the party at the time, and he was opposed by a fellow called Bill Waters, who I think probably will be remembered in the party, because Bill Waters was a fairly good bloke, wasn't he? He was also a busman, I think. And Bill Waters opposed the forming of the breakaway union. In the Radical Aristocrat Act book, you can see it written that he was a party member at the time. He wasn't, and the party certainly wouldn't support breakaway unions. Anyway, I'll pass them around. I'm keeping those in the little box thing there. Yeah. But you can have a look at them. Oh, and this is actually a pamphlet which goes with it, which is from the London Busman's Rank and File Movement. I think it's rather a nice one. And the other thing about the London Busman's Rank and File Movement is that the communists, after the rank and file was betrayed, the communists actually opted out. They said, oh no, we'll go back in the union, if you like. And they rose to become quite prominent in the TGWU. Right. The war. I hope have I got some time left?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I'm sure people get up and walk out if they've had enough.
That's good. Second World War. During the Second World War, originally the Communist Party took the view that it was an imperialist war. But strangely enough, as soon as Poland was invaded from the east, from the Russian point of view, they turned around and said it was an anti-fascist war to start with, then it was an imperialist war. So it was an about turn. But to be fair to them, if you think the Soviet Union was socialist, then you should do exactly what the interests of the Soviet Union tell you to, whether that's opposing fascism or, as it turned out, kind of uniting with them. This is the People's Convention. This was the thing from 1941. Now, we took the view that we wouldn't have said it was an imperialist war, we said it was a capitalist war, but it's a similar sort of idea. But the Communist Party, I was actually surprised that when I got the Communist Party's current history, they actually mentioned this at all, because I would have thought it would have been a bit of a black sheep in the family, because although they opposed the war, and we did too, what we didn't do is suggest that we make a peace treaty with Adolf Hitler, which is essentially what the People's Convention is. They called it a people's peace. I don't think that was a very good idea, and I don't think it would have really worked, but that's the People's Convention. It was fairly popular in its time, because I don't think in 1940 people actually were very keen on the war. It was costing people a lot of a lot of lives. It was the time of the Blitz. I could kind of understand people saying, no, we don't want to fight that one. It resulted in the Daily Worker. This thing here directly resulted in the Daily Worker being suppressed, and the CPG being narrowly escaped, being banned altogether, and all of the people in it, like Pollitt, being shipped off to the Isle of Man, possibly at the south end, whereas the fascists were in the north. There we go, that's the People's Convention. Of course, after the invasion of Russia in 1941, it switched back again. Then it was People's War, and the big thing was the Second Front. I haven't got anything of the Second Front. I'm very, very sad about that, because I was wanting something, but I have no idea whether they issued it or not. A lot of the things from about that time are actually from the Russians directly, so they're saying about the war. And this was when the Communist Party actually rose to its greatest heights, and I think it was reflected by the fact that for a lot of the war, the Soviets were the only people, so the Russians were the only people who were really fighting the war. The British government did not really want to invade France in 1944, let alone 1943 or whatever. They didn't want to go because they were scared of the trenches, because it would have meant that they might have had a revolution or something like that. They were very scared of putting in anyone in, but the Soviets were Russians, if you like. They were fighting, and this is, I think, the Communist Party picked up on this, and that's how they got their biggest numbers, which were, incidentally, 56,000, which was biggest any left party's ever had in this country. Right, this is my best bit, which is about the party. In 1943, or sometime like that, I haven't actually found the date, the West Ham, East End branch, actually sent a message saying, could we have a debate with the Communist Party? And they replied as follows. The Communist Party of West Ham replied as follows. It's a nice, friendly response. The Communist Party has no dealings with murderers, liars, renegades, or assassins. That means you folks. The SPGB, which associates itself with followers of Trotsky, the friend of Hess, has always followed a policy which would mean disaster for the British working class. They have consistently poured vile slanders on Joseph Stalin and the Communist Party, told filthy lies about the Red Army, the Soviet people and its leaders, gloated upon the assassination of Kirov and other Soviet leaders, applauded the wrecking activities of Trotsky's saboteurs in the Soviet Union, and are, in short, agents of fascism in Great Britain. The CPGB refuses with disgust to deal with such renegades. We treat them as vipers to be destroyed. Now, I'm rather hoping that there's not any members of the Communist Party in the audience, just in case they've got some anti-snake things, because they have, I think I might run away. But I thought that was a very nice thing to say. I don't know what our response would have been to that. It would have been, And I particularly like the agents of fascism, because also in the archive upstairs, we've actually got the bones of Adolf Hitler. It's in a little casket upstairs. They're treasured mementos of history.